Last week, we heard the story of the people in the wilderness creating and worshipping a golden calf, an idol. And this week, we hear a reconciliation of sorts, even though Yahweh says to Moses, "No one shall see my face and live." Nonetheless, Yahweh promises Moses and by implication the people a measure of protection. What we don't hear is the price of that reconciliation in the verses preceding today's section from Exodus. The people who had previously stolen jewelry and gold from the Egyptians must now strip themselves of all ornamentation. They must forego their jewelry if they are to move back into right relations with the one who brought them out of bondage in Egypt. They are to forego things that get in the way of right relationship for them. They had understandable anxiety after the debacle with the idol, but then idols are often, if not always, a source of anxiety. We can make an idol out of anything, but it's always something we treat as though it was God, as though an idol comes into being when we organize our lives around something that is not ultimately life-giving, orienting ourselves toward it, placing our trust in its mythical power to save. I believe at some level we in our current society have done this with our adulation of the family, for example, and family values as the repository of all that is good and holy and righteous. When we turn the family or anything else that is good into an idol, we put more weight on it than can bear, and the institution begins to break down. We see that all over the place. And yes, family is important. So are all kinds of committed relationships, nurturing and loving parents, children who honor those parents, and so on. And yes, family can mean home and safety and protection, but family cannot save us. Family cannot cure what ails us, especially when it's the family relationships themselves that are the problem. Is it possible that we turn something wonderful into a kind of idol? Take this a step further and consider our societal anxiety around children. A few years ago, the turnover in school board chiefs in this country was at an alarmingly high rate, with something like 75% of school board chiefs lasting no more than 4 or 5 years in their jobs. What is that about if it's not about our investing more in the lives of children than reality can bear, and funneling all our consequent anxiety into the institutions that are supposed to help us raise our children? So school officials, in return, keep putting responsibility back on the family, where they think it belongs, and off we go again. False gods cannot bear the weight we ask them to carry, and precious institutions begin to show signs of the strain. I recently came across a book review. The book was called The Altars Where We Worship, The Religious Significance of Popular Culture. I've not read the book, and I probably won't, tell you the truth, but the review was great. The authors of the book apparently look at the altars on which we worship, the body and sex, technology, big business, politics, sports, entertainment. You know the terrain. And the reviewer, Dr. Ronald Wells of Calvin College, says this. He says, "The alternative religions the authors describe so well are mostly culturally manipulative, even dystopian. They offer a devastating critique of North American culture, finding it mainly materialistic, superficial, individualistic, and narcissistic. It may be the real world, says Dr. Wells, but we do not have to like it." They, the authors, wind up quoting well-known Christian authors to say that instrumental religion meant to satisfy is not real religion at all. The real item, what is ultimately satisfying, can only obtain if sacrifice is at its core. Amen, says Dr. Wells. So idolatry, in which we're all caught up at some level, is alive and well today. And we can perhaps therefore begin to glimpse that there is more to our story of the Pharisees and Herodians trying to triangulate Jesus in their game of gotcha. The Pharisees were what we would recognize as a religious party, the Herodians we would recognize as a political party, but here their interests are aligned. Will Jesus incite revolution or not? At issue is something like nationalism. Caesar, the emperor, had blasphemously claimed divine status. In the eyes of faithful Israel, paying taxes was, for some, therefore, an act of capitulation or even infidelity. But for the Roman authorities, such payments were a matter of course and expected of a subject people. So what does Jesus do? Jesus declines, as he often does, the binary either-or answer and reframes the sovereignty conversation. Whose head or image is on the coin? Why? The emperor, of course. So therefore give to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, and to God the things that are God's. The Romans will hear vindication and support for paying taxes to Caesar. The Jews would hear the connection with Genesis chapter 1 and would quickly understand that those who bear the image of God are those of us who are created in God's image. So what is it that should be rendered to God? Why, nothing less than our whole selves, our whole being. Jesus doesn't get into the argument about whether it's Rome first or make Israel great again. Jesus is once again raising the bar. Don't turn nationalism or coinage or money or material possession into idols, because that's just all they are. Not necessarily bad in themselves. They are just nationalism, coinage, money or material possession, but they are not God. Orient yourselves instead toward what really matters to life, the self-giving love of God made manifest in Jesus. Our bishop reminded us last week that God will not be mocked, will not be fooled if we appear to focus on the question of taxation rather than real meaning and purpose. I'm reminded, we're headed into stewardship season next month, and I'm reminded of a fairly common conversation that comes up around that, which is a tithe or a gift of 10% before or after taxes? And I always want to say, which are you doing now? Because that usually sorts out the truth that we're bobbing and weaving rather than rendering unto God the things that are God's. I'm also reminded of an encounter that I had nearly 2 years ago now with the rector of a large Episcopal evangelical church in San Antonio. We were on a kind of career assessment retreat for people, clergy eligible, deemed eligible for retirement. And he and I are probably the only two there who weren't desperate to retire. We were still had plenty of life left in us. But he wasn't happy with how things were going. He kept saying over and over, he said, people are just indifferent to the gospel. They're just indifferent to the gospel. And I eventually got a little frustrated with this, and I said, they're not indifferent to meaning and purpose. People are indifferent to the rather bizarre package in which we have put meaning and purpose. And he took that to heart, and we had a lot of conversation about it. I believe that our worship makes sense for a lifetime once it's taught, but it's not immediately accessible to many who wander in off the street. But our friends will only stop to learn what we're doing if they sense that our lives are authentic. And our testimony is inviting. We need to serve coffee on the way into church, as our bishop suggested last week. Cup holders on the end of the pews, anyone? That really doesn't bother me if what we're doing has integrity. I recently read about a church that has put massage chairs in the front row for visitors. And I don't think that's in our future, honestly, but it's not really who we are. But by all means, bring coffee into church, but render unto God the things that are God's. Remember what's really important here. What we're about is turning to what really matters and letting our servant sovereign, in whose image we are made, guide and govern our lives as we become ever more the people we were created to be. People not known for idolatry and anxiety and getting all wound up and bent out of shape about whatever is going on. Carolina football might be one of those things. Terrible. But known instead for our love and our service, our generosity, our authenticity, and the sense that we are in fact alive and that something's going on here that frees us to be the people we were created to be. Next month, we'll be asked to make gifts or commitments in support of God's work through us as a community of faith.